Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show on BBS Radio. It is Saturday, June 8th, 2012. And at the moment, I'm not in my usual habitat back south of Ottawa, but I'm in southern British Columbia. And I've spent the last week traveling across Canada in my van and viewing the beautiful Canadian countryside. And I've arrived in British Columbia in southern BC at the moment. And I'm on my way to the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Conference, which is coming up this week. And we have the one of the principal organizers of that conference as a guest today, Jim Fetzer, and we're going to have a very interesting show. What we're going to do, we're going to have Jim on for the first hour of the show, and then Dee and I'll carry forward through to the end with additional news commentary, and I'll share more of my travels and impressions. So first, I'll bring on Dee. How are you, Dee?
I'm living, which is better than the alternative, Christopher, and I'm glad you're enjoying your trip out to B.C.
Yes, it's very wet there.
Yes, and I do want to point out right from the top that we were going to have Alfred Lambermont Weber on along with Professor Jim Fetzer today. Unfortunately, Alfred has laryngitis and can't join us. However, he will join us on our next show. He has confirmed for our next show, so that's after the conference. So he will provide us then with the update, and now Professor Fetzer can tell us what it's all about and perhaps focus our attention on what needs to be done and how this is supposed to proceed. So I think we have a really good setup going on now. Despite the laryngitis, we've come through again with another schedule that is going to meet everyone's approval, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Oh, Dee, sure. Thanks. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, we have a great lineup at the Vancouver hearings. I'll be sure to mention some of the principal speakers. It's going to open with Splitting the Sky, who is a magnificent native North American who attempted a citizen's arrest of George W. Bush the last time he was in Canada. Just as Alfred Weber has proven himself to be such a significant participant in the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, from which he has just returned, where they found George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and others in their administration guilty of war crimes related to 9/11 and the wars of aggression that followed. He has done great work. And we're very, very proud to have him as a judge at the Vancouver hearings.
This is excellent. And Christopher, I know you're headed out there, so you're going to have a bird's eye view of all of this, which is really going to be neat.
It's immensely exciting. It really is. I feel that this is a far more advanced 9/11 conference, looking at a whole new generation of issues and deeper analysis, like in terms of looking at the demolition of the buildings and what might have been involved in that, and more detail about what went on in the Pentagon and the role of the media and the idea of the fabled airplanes, that the media helped actually stage some of 9/11. Gets into looking more at the origins and who's behind it.
Yeah, not to mention, where did the money go with all the put options and all of that kind of stuff that went on? And, you know, there were even fingers that extended into Canada, because I know the CIBC, Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, was nailed on stock options on on the World Trade Center. So, I mean, you know, everybody and their dog who's making money on the backs of the people had their fingers in that pie somehow.
Dee, you're making a great point. You know, even the chairs, the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, former congressional representative, and Thomas Keene, former governor of New Jersey, reported that they had traced the put options back to their source, but that they had clearly had nothing to do with it, which was a stupendous blunder on their part, because the source to which they traced it back was the Central Intelligence Agency, which had a major hand in planning 9/11. So if they would only follow the evidence and logic where it leads, rather than begging the question by taking for granted that the agency was not involved in this, we'd be light years ahead of where we are now in exposing the truth about 9/11.
Well, of course. I mean, the bottom line on this whole thing has always been that they've played the game of plausible deniability, and the stupid part of it was that their deniability wasn't plausible at all. But because of the fact that most people are dumbed down to the point where they cannot imagine their own elected representatives actually having a hand in murdering their own citizens, their mind just went on tilt. And then they hear George Bush 2 days later saying, well, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. There's your Delphi technique. There's narrowing the argument, Hegelian dialectic, and no matter who you pick, you're in trouble.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a specious bifurcation. He was giving you two choices that were false choices because, I mean, it was begging the question again by assuming he knew the answer when, in fact, he was complicit in the cover-up. This had been carefully orchestrated by the American intelligence agencies, the American military, and the Mossad. It was a national security event, I'm convinced, Dee, that had the approval of all the highest echelons of the American government. And something Christopher was implying, I think, is quite correct. This conference is going to go where other 9/11 conferences in general have not dared to go. We're going to talk about the Pentagon, what did or didn't happen, where there's overwhelming evidence that no Boeing 757 did not hit the Pentagon. We're going to go to different theories about how the Twin Towers were destroyed. In Toronto, for example, they mumbled about nanothermite, but they really didn't explain it. One of the judges was so puzzled, he even asked Kevin Ryan if nanothermite had ever been used to destroy a building, and Kevin Ryan had to admit, no, it never had. And the judge said, well, why are we talking about it then? And Kevin Ryan said, well, because we're talking about a deceptive, conspiracy theory, which I thought was very strange, very bizarre. Well, we're not going to mince words like that. We're going to get to the heart of the matter. We're going to compare alternative theories. We're going to demonstrate it can't possibly have been a collapse. We're going to show nanothermite could only have played a most trivial role here because it doesn't have the explosive capability to blow those buildings apart in every direction. We're going to examine the possible use of mini or micro nukes, and directed energy weapons are also going to come into play, subjects that don't dare even be mentioned by some of these groups. Yeah. And then we're going to have, after having two sessions devoted to the Twin Towers, we're going to look at who was responsible and why. We even have Susan Lindauer, a former CIA asset, who, when she complained about George Bush's plans to invade Iraq were unconstitutional and illegal, was harassed, prosecuted, drugged. I mean, her story is a harrowing one of somebody who tried to blow the whistle. We're going to have Kevin Barrett address the background for 9/11. We're going to have Alan Sabrowski examine the role of Israeli intelligence here. And we're going to have Joshua Blakeney, with whom I organize this, who's been studying the origins of the global war on terror, also contribute. Sunday, then, the next day, Christopher and I, and a fellow who's an expert in technical aspects of military aircraft and electronics and communication, are going to address the fabrication of these flights and the crash sites. And then we're going to turn to the role of the media here. And it should be really quite sensational because the media really played a crucial role in covering things up, as the illustration of Jane Stanley, who was an announcer for the BBC, reported how Building 7 had already collapsed at 4:57, which was 23 minutes early. An astonishing gaffe, very rare, clearly displaying complicity between the intelligence agencies, the mass media, and the government. That during that final session, we're going to have John McCarthy, who was a combat veteran in Vietnam and who will address the role of the Department of Defense and the CIA in false flag terrorism. Webster Tarpley, is going to talk about the covert operations in our time. He, of course, is the author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA. And Anthony Hall, who's the founding coordinator of Globalization Studies at Lethbridge, the author of The American Empire in the Fourth World, will be talking about how the media have failed us all. I think it's going to be quite sensational. And for those who would like to see the full program and all of the speakers, they should go to the homepage for the Vancouver hearings, which, and this is a case where you actually need the three W's, 3W's.911VancouverHearings.com, and you can see the whole shebang.
That would be excellent, because I'll tell you, you know, when you look at all of the information, I mean, I got to tell you, when my phone rang on the morning of 911 saying, Dee, are you watching the news? Well, that time of day, because I work late at night, no, I'm not usually even awake. So I very groggily climb out of bed and turn on the TV, and I see, you know, the repeated ad nauseam repetition of the building getting hit, and then over and over and over this repetitive mantra that they imposed on people. See the building going down, hear the word terrorist, connect the two. And in the meantime, I'm looking at this building going down. I went, wait a minute, that's a controlled demolition if I ever saw one. I mean, I'm not an idiot. I've seen controlled demolitions before. No building goes down like that from a crash of any variety at any time. It doesn't go to nanoparticles.
You're absolutely right, Dee. When I watched that happen, I said to myself, this is fantastic. You know, this is a fantasy. This is deceptive and fraudulent. And I also thought to myself, but I'll probably never be in a position to do anything about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I have wound up in a position to do something about it. I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December 2005. And we took off from there. We have organized conferences. We've sponsored lectures. We have published press releases. We have done interview after interview after interview. I mean, I think that the society has made a huge difference. In fact, if you were to study the number of articles and discussion in the mainstream media prior to the founding of Scholars, it was a flat line. Once Scholars was founded, it began to steadily climb. And now I would say discussion of 9/11 is a really a rather broad spread phenomenon outside of the mainstream media, which, of course, is doing all it can to suppress any discussion about the discoveries we've made and the refutations of the official account, which the Bush administration promulgated, which is only the most outrageous and easily falsified of all the theories about 9/11.
Mm-hmm. I got to ask you this question, Jim, because it's become apparent to me, and I know it must be apparent to you, there's a real split in the 911 movement between the guys who believe there were planes and the guys who don't believe there were planes. And I'm wondering, do you think that that kind of thing is basically a deliberate attempt to bifurcate anything that has to do with 911 so that there's a conflict inside that movement, thereby crippling the movement to a degree? Has that been a big factor? Because it sure seems to me that all of the arguments going on inside the movement itself, this is a typical way of infiltration that we know they use in many, many areas. They put somebody in place and then they kind of split the movement into, and your power goes with it.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dee. It's called divide and conquer. Factions, you know, within the movement against one another. And there have been many efforts to do this. There are some out there who think we shouldn't talk about the Pentagon because it's going to spring a new video showing what hit it. But that's completely ridiculous. We have all the evidence. We see the complete absence of debris. We know that no plane hit there, even Major General Albert Stubblebine, who was responsible for all U.S. photographic intelligence, gave an interview to a German reporter in which he explained that he could tell that no plane had hit the Pentagon because there was no imprint of the wings on the walls of the building, which are 2 feet thick. They have a foot of concrete and then 8 inches of brick, and then 4 inches of limestone, which is a relatively soft porous stone, so that if a plane had actually hit there, the imprint would have been indelible, but it wasn't there. Would you believe, not only at the actual hit point, which is only about 10 feet high and 16 or 17 feet wide, there's no massive pile of debris. There is no stack from a 100-ton airliner, no wings, no tail, no bodies, no seats, no luggage. There are unbroken windows. There's a chain-link fence. There are a couple of enormous spools of cable, two cars. But no remnant of any airplane, not even the engines, were recovered. In fact, a civilian employee by the name of April Gallup, who was inside the building when this explosion occurred, walked out through the hole, looked around, and has reported seeing no indications whatsoever of any plane having hit there. Just as Jamie McIntyre, this noted CNN reporter, explained to his anchor when she asked about the plane, said, well, you know, from my close-up inspection, there's no sign of any big plane having hit anywhere near the Pentagon. And, of course, we have photograph after photograph after photograph of the clear, green, unblemished lawn. In fact, debris only started showing up later. And if you can believe this, Dee, the most noted piece of debris, which was a section from the fuselage of a 757, showed no signs of having been exposed to intense fire. It wasn't crunched. It didn't look as though it had come out of a violent crash, such as the government claims. And when you look closely, you find entwined in it is a piece of vine. In fact, James Hansen, an attorney from Columbus, Ohio, has traced this piece of fuselage back to a crash that occurred in Cali, Colombia in 1995 in a jungle there where vines of this kind are commonplace. It was kind of a slow-motion crash that peeled this piece of fuselage off the plane, so they evidently kept it in storage so they could trot it out for the Pentagon as a prop. I mean, the extent to which they have used Hollywood-style special effects is embarrassing. We also know that with regard to the alleged crash in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, that there's a big ditch there, but there's no debris. In fact, two of the first reporters on the scene explained how the eerie aspect of the crash site was that there were no indications that any plane had crashed there.
No, they said it looked
like he ceased being coroner after 15 minutes because there were no bodies, and he later reported, Dee, that he didn't find a speck of blood. I mean, it's ridiculous to claim that a plane crashed in Shanksville.
Yeah, and not only that, as I recall, they were also reporting that it looked like explosions had been set off in the ground. These looked like craters from explosions, not the trench that would have been dug by an airliner hitting the ground and even blowing up. There was no singeing, no nothing. In fact, it didn't look like much happened there at all. So,
Colonel George, U.S. Air Force retired, observed that it looked to him as though someone had gone out there with a bulldozer, dug a trench, filled it with trash, and blown it up. I mean,
yeah.
It's quite embarrassing because, you know, there's no signs of any aircraft having crashed there.
Well, not only that, but you bring up the tracing of the fuselage to a crash in Colombia. Well, hello. The CIA runs all kinds of drug operations in Colombia, as we know. And if anybody's ever seen Air America, they know how they got that piece of fuselage.
Yeah, that's good, Dee. Well, let me make a couple of general points about this thing about planes, no planes. You have to understand what the theory means. It means that the officially claimed crashes didn't occur. It means that Flight 11 did not hit the North Tower. Flight 77 did not hit the Pentagon. Flight 93 did not crash in Shanksville. And Flight 175 did not hit the South Tower. And there's a mountain of supporting evidence, which I'm going to present at the conference, including that we know from Bureau of Transportation Statistics records that flights 11 and 77 weren't even scheduled to fly that day, Dee. And we know from FAA registration data that the planes corresponding to Flight 93 and to Flight 175 were not officially deregistered, that means taken out of service, until 28 September 2005. So the question becomes, how can planes that weren't in the air have crashed on 9/11? And how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? If that isn't astonishing enough, the Pilots for 9/11 Truth has been doing brilliant work, and they have studied air ground communications, and they have established that Flight 93 was in the air, but was over Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, at the very time it was supposed to be crashing in Shanksville.
When I saw the flight path that was shown on TV, and I'm looking at these
things can be made up effortlessly. And
they apparently
was also
were.
In the air, but it was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at the time it was supposed to be entering the South Tower. So we know some kind of fakery or fabrication is going on. Those planes nowhere near the sites where they were alleged to have crashed.
Yeah. Well, I was about to say, when I watched the flight paths that they publicized on TV, it looked to me like it was some kind of a comedy of errors, like a movie, because the planes were literally going all over the place. They didn't seem to know where the hell they were supposed to be going.
That may have been intended to convey the impression that incompetent pilots were flying them, but these guys were so incompetent they couldn't possibly have flown these sophisticated aircraft. I mean, they wouldn't even be able to identify all the controls or what they meant. When you're up there at high altitude, you don't have any geographical signposts to guide you. You're looking at clear sky and clouds.
Yeah,
and unless
exactly.
you know how to fly using instruments, you're not going to have a prayer. Well, none of these guys had a prayer. None of these guys were competent. But, you know, a point you're making, too, relates to the fact that the Department of Defense was conducting a very large number of drills on 9/11. Webster Tarpley has found a minimum of 17, maybe as many as 27, that were designed to keep American aircraft from responding to a hijacking. In fact, back in June, not quite six months earlier, the standard operating procedure had been changed so that instead of area commanders having the authority to respond to a hijacking and even shoot down the plane if the circumstances required it, Donald Rumsfeld required now that all such responses be authorized by him personally. And when the time came on 9/11, he was missing in action for about 2 hours. No one knew where he was at all until all of a sudden he pops up on the lawn helping to carry a stretcher, which is an absurd thing for the Secretary of Defense to be doing if there's the real possibility that the nation is under attack. But what
happened is this.
They had all these phony blips for imaginary aircraft on the air traffic controller's screens all over the eastern United States. And when the report came that there were supposed to be real hijackings, all those blips ought to have been removed. But instead of removing them, they left them there so that the air traffic controllers didn't know if what they were looking at was real or was Memorex.
And, of course, what you're referring to here is, in fact, to a degree, a comedy of errors. It's sort of like the guys at the top end knew what they were doing, but every time they added in someone to play a part, somebody screwed up somewhere.
I think there are all kinds of ways that happened. There certainly were mistakes made on 9/11. I would say, you know, we also have, you know, mentioned the excellent speakers who are going to address the Pentagon, the witnesses and the passengers already on Friday night, including Enver Massad, the chief executive officer of the Wisdom Fund, who has published a book, The War on Islam, and another entitled 9/11 Unveiled. What's fascinating about him is not only is he an engineer, but he lives in the vicinity of the Pentagon, and he actually observed its condition immediately after the hit. Another is Barbara Honecker, who is a former White House policy analyst who spent more than a decade as a senior military affairs journalist at the Department of Defense, and who is going to write about how the Pentagon attacked itself. And then Dean Hartwell, who's been doing a great deal of research on what became of the passengers. He's published a book entitled Planes Without Passengers, The Fake Hijackings of 9/11, is going to address that question, planes and passengers, what became of them. It's a great way to begin this historic event.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, you get into little issues like, you know, the let's roll aspect. They made a movie out of it, and it's like, it's so ridiculous. Then all the cell phone calls that were purportedly made, and yet none of them ever showed up on anyone's bill. And of course, people who are in that communications industry and are engineers in that area have said there's no bloody way they could call from a cell phone at 500 miles an hour, because you'd be out of one reception zone, one roaming zone, and into another. You'd never be able to connect. So how did these calls...
Well, you're making very, very good points. In fact, Elias Davidson, S-S-O-N, who is a European scholar, has established the government has never been able to prove any of the hijackers were aboard any of the planes.
No,
and
the only
A.K.
thing they
Dooney,
had is proof.
A professor of computer science at Western Ontario, actually took three different types of cell phones and flew many flights to discover that at speeds above 200 miles an hour and altitudes above 2,000 feet, they become extremely unreliable. Because, as you're implying, the microwave relay stations can't switch the messages fast enough. In fact, it's only been with great fanfare that American airliners have announced within the last year that it's now possible to make cell phones from their aircraft, which wasn't possible before. And while we have no less a prominent figure than Ted Olson, who was the Solicitor General of the United States, which means that he represents, or did then, the United States before the Supreme Court, claimed to have received several phone calls from his wife, Barbara, who was supposed to have been aboard Flight 77. He gave three different versions involving cell phones, and then when he learned cell phones couldn't be used, he claimed air phones, but in fact, in credit cards. But the fact of the matter is that those Boeing 757s, of which Flight 77 was supposed to be one, did not have functional air phones aboard those planes at the time. So here you have the Solicitor General of the United States lying to the American people. In fact, even the FBID has confirmed that no phone calls from his wife were received by Ted Olson on 9/11. I mean, how bad is that?
That's really bad. I mean, the whole thing was, if you wrote a movie script, the continuity guys would be fired. Because it's the truth. It's one thing that continuity is one of the most difficult things to do when completing a movie. You have to make everything match. Otherwise, visually, it won't make sense. And in this particular case, whoever was trying to sort out all the continuity and all these lies did a damn bad job of it, because there were flags all over the map. Everywhere you turned, there was some kind of falsehood that was too obvious for anybody who wasn't caught up in that, you got to get those terrorists, look what they did to us. If you weren't sucked into that mode, you could still think. And if you could still think, you could see without the aid of a magnifying glass that there was something really fishy going on.
You're absolutely right, Dean. I'd like to mention, you know, for those who cannot make it to Vancouver and who may be moaning that fact, they should know that, in fact, the conference is going to be live-streamed worldwide. And you
Excellent.
Can find out how to catch it, how to tune in, by going to liveonlocation.tv, liveonlocation.tv. Where
Excellent.
You can find out how to access the conference, which will be live-streamed worldwide.
Well, I hope you're going to send out some promo on that. I'd be happy to forward it to my list and recommend that they forward it as well, because, you know, the big thing that is troubling at this point is a lot of people are looking at 911 as kind of water under the bridge. That was 11 years ago, you know. How can we do anything about it now? But I don't think these people are realizing this was the linchpin to the whole operation. Without this event, without this false flag, we would not be in the situation we were in today. There's no way.
What you're saying is so important. I mean, it has been used as the justification not only for the invasion of Afghanistan, which took place already on October 7th, I mean, just weeks after 9/11, But also for the invasion of Iraq, we have slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghans. It's just a terrible, terrible situation. We have depleted the American treasury. We have weakened our military by constant rotation. And we have indelibly tarnished our reputation in the world, where we were once the most admired and respected country in the world, but now we're among the most despised and reviled, along with our ally in the Middle East, Israel. We are the big bullies on the block. In fact, no nation stood to gain more from 9/11 than Israel, especially by dismantling these sophisticated Arab states, such as Iraq, which had a national health care system, national public education, reliable infrastructure providing water and electricity, antiquities and artifacts dating back thousands of years. Well, we have destroyed almost all of that. I mean, it's completely disgusting. And, of course, this was a complete reversal of American foreign policy, because before 9/11, we had never attacked any country that hadn't attacked us first. And the claims that Osama bin Laden was involved were simply ridiculous. Osama bin Laden was a creature of the CIA. He was our man in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
when the Russians, when the Soviets
Altman.
Invaded, we used him to help supply the resistance movement there with the Stinger missiles that took down Russian helicopters and planes and made it impossible for the military presence of the Soviet Union to remain. A CIA agent even visited him in Dubai, where he was undergoing treatment for his kidney problems, which required dialysis. He actually, when he was first asked about 9/11, he explained that he had nothing to do with it, that it was against the tenets of the Quran to murder innocent women and children. He said that there was a government within the government that wanted to cast blame upon him and other Muslims, where that same sentiment was echoed by no less an authority than William Jefferson Clinton, who observed there was a government within the government and that he did not control it. When American representatives confronted the Taliban and insisted that Osama bin Laden be turned over to the United States, the Taliban very appropriately said that if we could produce proof that Osama had been involved, that they would do that. We made lots of claims that we would produce such proof, but we never have. And, of course, we went ahead and invaded the country anyway, mm-hmm. in spite of it. In fact, when the FBI was asked, when Ed Haas of the Muckraker Report, an online investigative journal, why Osama bin Laden on his wanted poster was not being sought for 9/11. An FBI official by the name of Rex Toomb, T-O-M-B, responded that it was because the FBI had no hard evidence that Osama bin Laden had anything to do with 9/11. And
well,
that is the case. In fact, Osama died on or about 15 December 2001. He was buried in an unmarked grave. There were local obituaries that even made it onto Fox News in February or March after that. And the fact of the matter is, all of the recordings and interviews and so forth attributed to him ever since have been shown to be phony or fake by experts. There's an article on my blog by Nicholas Kullerstrom, who will also be speaking, and who happens to be an expert on the 7/7 subway attacks in the UK. He has a book, Terror on the Tube, that's now in its third edition. That's an article about Osama's life and death. But David Ray Griffin has even published a whole book about Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. I mean, the evidence that Osama died way back when is overwhelming. But it was very convenient for Barack Obama to resuscitate Osama and to kill him for the second time. I mean, the man was already dead. When he was in a political situation here about a year and a half ago.
Oh, yeah,
and
then
there was a lot of complaining that he hadn't closed Guantanamo, that he had troops in Pakistan, and his birth certificate was on the front page.
Well, the thing that got me going,
any signs of forgery or fakery.
Yeah, well, the thing that got me going, Jim, was the fact that when they said they caught Osama and killed him in the bunker, that they said that they gave him a traditional Muslim burial at sea. Well, there's no such thing as a traditional Muslim burial at sea.
You're absolutely right. That's disrespectful to the body. I mean, it's going to be eaten by the fish, sharks, crustaceans. The idea that that was a traditional burial, you know, Muslim burial, was a manifest absurdity. Not only that, but the whole raid was fake. We had this photograph showing Joe Biden and Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, all, you know, engrossed with what was supposed to be a large screen television following the raid in Pakistan. But Leon Panetta, then the head of the CIA, blew that out of the water when he observed that the first 20 or 25 minutes there was no live coverage. Well, these raids only take about 5 minutes, Dee. And the idea that, well, you know, they were faking this is just so embarrassing. I mean, the United States has just been reduced to one lie compounded by another.
Well, I mean, come on, Jim. You know, it goes back to that. The continuity specialist should have been fired on the spot, because you can take that same point and take it all the way back to Bush reading the story about the pet goat in the school, already knowing that the building has been supposedly hit. There's already been.
That, yes, that his expression, his demeanor doesn't change whatsoever, even when Andy Carter's chief of staff leans over and tells him there's been a second hit and that America is under attack. His expression doesn't change whatsoever. How is that possible? Unless he already knew this was coming, he was going to be told that it was part of a script. What's fascinating about this Bush thing on 9/11, D, is that later on two different public occasions, he would state that when he saw that he had some experience, you know, as a pilot in the Air National Guard in Texas.
Yeah, when he showed up.
When he saw that first plane, you know, hit the building, he thought to himself, man, what a terrible pilot. And he said, obviously, the television was on. Well, you know, there was only a 30-minute interval between the first and the second strike, so that there was a very short opportunity for him to have seen that without already knowing the second strike had occurred, after which you would never suggest that this guy was really a bad pilot.
Yeah, not only that, but
the first hit wasn't broadcast on television, certainly not before the following day. So it seems to me that George Bush, who's not the sharpest pencil in the box, was actually saying something he'd experienced, that he had watched this on television, but it has to have been a closed Secret Service television network that was set up, focused on the North Tower, when nobody else was paying any attention, because nobody else had any idea anything unusual was going to happen there.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, then you go back to the fact that he was in the limousine on the way to the school at the time the first tower was hit. This is according to the schedule that he had in Florida. I find it curious that he's in a Florida school.
This closed Secret Service TV network would be connected to the presidential limousine, so that corresponds to my take on what actually happened here.
Exactly. Then, of course, you look at him being informed in that video, and you're absolutely right. His expression did not change. He acted like somebody had just said to him, hurry up, we got to go for lunch.
I think Christopher wants to get a word in edgewise, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I did. You mentioned Osama saying about how there was a government within the government. And to me, that brings us back to why 9/11 is so important. Because I don't think there's any other event that can so awaken the American public to the fact that there is this government behind the government, that this whole thing has been a psyop, and it involved the media, the military, the intelligence agency. There's this whole government within the government, and I don't think anything shows that or helps people realize that to the same extent as does 9/11, that they actually allowed the perpetration of this fraud on the American public and world public. And then
didn't the Nazis say the bigger the lie, the better?
Well, for people to see that, that's why I've always felt that, like, 9/11 is their Achilles heel, because there's such overwhelming criminal evidence that in any impartial court with any half-sane judge, you could prove the complicity of these groups.
The problem I think has been largely that at the time of 9/11, America was in its state of being dumbed down. They would never have believed at that point that their government would do anything harmful. Now, 11 years later, of course, we're looking at another scenario entirely, because people are now convinced that their government would do nasty things to them. They're still having a little trouble with 3,000 people and a multi-billion-dollar building and all of this. They're really having trouble with that, because it really is so over the top, you know, in terms of the paradigm that they live in, and the beliefs that they have in mom and apple pie and the flag. I mean, I've known from a kid, since I was a kid, when I'm looking at Americans, and we had a lot of dealings with them because my dad worked for Burlington Northern Railroad, and we were back and forth into Minnesota all the time, and I had a lot more contact with Americans than other kids my age did. And, you know, I could not believe how indoctrinated they were, and I'm talking back in the 60s even. And now you've got a country that is gobsmacked. I mean, literally, their jaws are on the floor, because look what the hell has happened in New York. My God, what's going on? And the last thing they're going to believe is that their government had anything to do with it. So the struggle that you have been facing, Jim, and that others have been facing, I mean, I know that you reference all kinds of people like Dr. Judy Wood and all these other people in your work. And one of the biggest things that you're trying to overcome is a paradigm of thought in the public. And it's like, what's it going to take to get people to recognize, yes, your government will murder people? Yes,
that's absolutely right. And
tell the truth.
Those who don't think the government is lying to us about these things, just do a search on Common Ground Bamboozled. Because the latest issue of Common Ground, which is a wonderful magazine published in Vancouver, has an article entitled 9/11, Have We Been Bamboozled? That I authored, in which I present four stories that didn't make the mainstream news, that range from some you'll find easy to believe to some you'll find incredible, where I begin with story one, the collapse that wasn't a collapse. The government has told us that the Twin Towers collapsed, but while that's true of Building 7, where you can see all the floors come down at the same time,
you can see the squibs going on, too.
Discern their motion in space-time, and when it's over, there's a stack of debris, a rubble pile equal to about 12% of the original, or something like five floors deep, in the case of the Twin Towers. Blowing apart in every direction. You can't even see what's going on there because they're being blown apart. Every floor remains stationary, waiting its turn to be blown apart. This is a kind of destruction that requires a vast amount of explosives. It's not a gravity-driven collapse. I mean, the gross evidence contradicts that. And when it's all done, they're destroyed below ground level. That's the first story, and I give you links to substantiate it. The second is one that some of your own listeners may find difficult to appreciate. It's entitled The First Death of Saddam Hussein. The fact is that Saddam Hussein, his two sons, and about 60 members of his general staff were taken out at a restaurant in the suburbs of Baghdad already on 7 April 2003, about 3 weeks after we invaded Iraq. It was his death that was going to be announced at the Mission Accomplished event on Abraham Lincoln off the coast of San Diego until one of Bush's advisors realized that three presidents, Reagan, Carter, and Ford, had signed executive orders against the assassination of foreign heads of state. So if they had announced that Bush would have been subject to severe criticism, the B-1 bomber pilot, Chris Walker, who had dropped the two bombs that took all of them out, and when he returned to base was lionized, put on CNN, and given the Distinguished Flying Cross, even feted at the Crystal Cathedral by the Reverend Robert Schiller not long thereafter, where we have a videotape of that service, was flown back to Langley the day after the event at the Crystal Cathedral and told that while they admired his flying skills, that officially Saddam had gone away. And what they did was to put one of his doubles in that spider hole, subject him to prosecution, and then they hung him if there wasn't a little stage there. But I imagine that after making arrangements with him and promising him he'd be flown off to the South Pacific where he could drink, you know, spend the rest of his days drinking Mai Tais and basking in the sun with the bikini-clad young women, that they may have in fact simply allowed
10,000 virgins, yeah. With his 10,000 virgins. And you know what was funny to me is one of the first things I heard after they executed who they purported was Saddam Hussein was I heard that his wife said, "That's not my husband."
Yes. Yeah. Exactly,
you know,
right.
And then I'm saying he's in Colombia sipping pina coladas.
Well, Joe Vial, who was an Australian journalist, noticed that the teeth and the jaw were not those of Saddam. I followed that up and found official U.S. command photographs of Saddam and confirmed that he was right, that the person that they were prosecuting was one of his doubles. So I published about it, but I really learned most about it from the mother of the pilot, Yvonne Walker. Turned out to be brilliant research. She called me to tell me the story. And I said, Yvonne, I said, that's fantastic, but you have to support it and document it. And she sent me document after document after document. So that I interviewed her on my radio show, and I published articles about it. And if you go on to 911scholars.org and scroll down to the Mission Impossible Fiasco section, you'll find all these documents and records she sent. And it's really an astounding story. So if anyone wants to see, you know, the magnitude of the lies we're told, just go to Common Ground, Bamboozled, and they'll get this article with active links because this is the electronic version.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, Joseph, the publisher of Common Ground, is getting very brave these days. I'm very proud of him.
Oh, he's excellent. He's excellent. I was so impressed with this guy. The third story is the one I've already told about the second death of Osama bin Laden, where I show, you know, a picture of the real Osama compared to one of his frauds. And the fourth is from the Pentagon, and I think anyone who knows what I've had to say about the Pentagon will appreciate this one. It's very easy to believe, namely, when the Pentagon initially released those five frames, which is actually all they have ever released. Even the videos they have subsequently released don't show more about the attack than those five frames. Four of them are about the fireball, but one is conveniently labeled plane. And when you see that image just above the gate mechanisms, it's a very faint image of a plane, but it appears to be too small to be a Boeing 757 exuding a white trail, which pilots and aeronautical engineers have explained to me cannot be the exhaust from the jet engines, which would be black, but could be the trail from a missile being fired at the building. So I asked Jack White, who's a legendary photo analyst, if he could size the image of a Boeing 757 to the size of the tail of this plane. And the 757, which is 155 feet long, is more than twice as long as the plane, which can't possibly be a 757. So, you know, everything we've been told about the Pentagon turns out to be a massive lie.
Oh, I know. I saw that little video clip you're referring to, and I went, wait a minute, that ain't no plane. There's no way that's a plane.
It was certainly no Boeing aircraft. So we get back to that business about, you know, the four different theses that define no plane theory. Just to return to that ever so briefly, by the way, Dee, since we talked a lot about Flight 93 and Flight 77, 11 hitting the North Tower has always looked very peculiar. You have this Naudé Brothers film crew that were able to effortlessly swing their camera up and catch it. But it turns out that Marcus Eich has done some brilliant work on this, including a time sequence of the frames. And what you see in those frames is something that doesn't look anything like a Boeing 767, which has a 156-foot wide wingspan, which should span about, you know, three-quarters of the 208-foot wide facade of the North Tower. It's coming in at a slight angle. It's actually intersecting with seven different floors.
Yeah, not only that.
It consists of a steel truss filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete, which would impose enormous horizontal resistance. whatever it is that hits the building, it makes a funny pattern, a four-point pattern that defines a Z, but after the smoke clears, it's turned into an elongated V. And there's a new study, by the way, by a guy named Richard Hall that anyone can find online called the 3D study, in which he shows that through the smoke after the alleged impact, there are a lot of little tiny points of explosions going on that are blasting that hole in the side of the building. The 175 is a really fascinating case because the plane in that video is traveling at an impossible speed for standard 767.
Yeah, I've seen the pilot analysis.
Not only that, but we have images of it half in and half out of the building where there's no sign of any collision effects. In fact, one of our students, Joe Keith, who is an aeronautical engineer who designed the shaker system for Boeing, which is an on-the-ground system to shake the fuselage of an aircraft to see at what level of stress it will fall apart, observed that if you do a frame-by-frame advance, you can determine that the plane passes its whole length into the building in the same number of frames it passes its whole length in air, which is obviously a physical absurdity unless this massive 500,000-ton building poses no more resistance to the flight of a plane in its trajectory than air. So we know something is terribly wrong here. And the hypothesis, there's been three hypotheses about it, Dee. One is that it was done using computer-generated images. A second was that it was done using a method known as video compositing. The problem with both of those is they would affect the broadcast video, but it wouldn't affect what happened or was visible beforehand. We have a lot of witnesses who claim they saw something they took to be a plane. Since it cannot have been a real plane because it was performing feats that no real plane could perform, a number of us, including John Lear, who is our nation's most distinguished pilot, Stefan Grossman, who's actually done a study of the absence of collision effects here, and Stephen Brown, who had taken a course in collography at Cambridge, all of whom I've interviewed on my radio show, have been disposed to recognize the only hypothesis that can explain all this data would be a hologram, because a hologram could be projected faster than a real 767. A hologram could enter the building in violation of Newton's laws. A hologram could pass through its own length into the building in the same number of frames it passes through its own length in air, which seems to be the most viable explanation. Now, we have not known how it was projected. And here, this new study by Richard Hall, which you can find by doing a search on Richard Hall 3D analysis of radar data, determined by studying all the videos, the flight path and the altitude of the plane seen in the videos. He, after establishing that, and he even found that the National Transportation Safety Board had data that corresponded to his data for the approach of that plane, he discovered there was a separate military radar data, but that corresponded to a plane that was 1,400 feet to the right, D, of the plane that had been seen entering the building. And what he hypothesizes, and what I believe is true, is that this other plane, 1,400 feet to the side, was projecting the image of the plane. So you have these two parallel flight paths of the projected image and the real plane. And on the military data, only the real plane shows up, which of course makes sense since a holographic projection would not show up on radar. And when he applied the same analysis to the hit on the North Tower, he found the same pattern with regard to the radar tracks, that there was military radar data for a real plane that was 1,400 feet to the right of the projected image, which was a different image, a very odd image hitting the North Tower. So I believe we have here the final piece of a very complicated puzzle. And anyone who studies no-plane theory is going to realize that there's a tremendous amount of corroborating evidence that Flight 11 did not hit the North Tower, that Flight 77 did not hit the Pentagon, that Flight 93 did not crash in Shanksville, and remarkably enough, that Flight 175, which you'll remember was over Pittsburgh at the time, did not hit the South.
Yeah, well, I tell you, somebody's going to have a hell of a movie one day to write about this, because it is the most magnificent deception. It it's out there in plain view. Anybody with a critical eye, anybody who can think logically, can do nothing but come up with question marks. That's the very best scenario that this whole thing leads to, is question marks. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I don't care what your scenario, but if it leads to nothing but question marks, it's back to the drawing board and dig some more. And here we have stuff that, as you rightly point out, this stuff, to anybody who knows their stuff, is so obvious it's not even funny. And I think the elite would do well to get shows off air like Monster Man, where we learn how special effects are done, and to, you know, show all this stuff, because, you know, what you're saying, as far as the computer-generated graphics and all that kind of stuff, 10 years ago, people wouldn't have known what the heck you were talking about. But you know what? Nowadays, just about everybody does.
Well, let me add one more point about the Pentagon, Dee, since that's an object of great interest. Pilots for 9/11 Truth obtained black box data from the National Transportation Safety Board. It claimed to come from Flight 77. When they analyzed, they discovered that instead of the barely skimming the ground, 500-mile-an-hour taking out lamppost approach that the government claims occurred, which was an acute northeast approach, there was this data corresponded to a plane in a due east approach that was 300 feet in the air, too high to hit any lampposts. That 1 second from the Pentagon, it was still 100 feet in the air and swerved over it, which corresponds to the report of the trucker buddy of a friend of mine from JFK Research, Roy Schaefer, who told me that Dave Ball had been in front of the building and had seen a big plane fly toward it and then swoop over it, which occurred at the same time explosions were set off there, and that Roy was very concerned because Dave still seemed to think a plane had hit the building, even though he hadn't seen a plane hit the building. I told Roy I'd like to get Dave on the air to talk about it. He approached Dave, but he was very reluctant to do it. And within a couple of weeks, he was found dead in an abandoned building. This is reminiscent of Barry Jennings, who was from the New York City Emergency Management and went to Building 7 in the morning. He went up to Mayor Giuliani's command and control post, where he had its own independent water and air supply. He found half-eaten sandwiches and still smoking cups of coffee. A fireman came along and said, "We got to get you out of here." He heard explosions going off inside the building. A staircase fell out from under him. At one point, he felt himself stepping over dead bodies. He couldn't see them because it was pitch black, but he could feel them. When he got outside into the air, he gave reporters his stories or some interview.
Hello.
Hello, Dee?
Yeah, I'm still here. What happened to Jim?
I'm still here.
Okay, good.
I'm still here. Dee, I'll just wrap it with one more point. When NIST was about to establish its final report, a few days later, Barry Jennings was found dead, a report that Barry Jennings was in the position to personally contradict. The government's playing hardball on 9/11. It's got all the ops out there, and they're trying to mislead us about every aspect of what we have learned regarding the truth about the atrocities of those days, which appears to have been a national security event authorized by the highest levels of the American government to instill fear into the American people in order to manipulate us to promote a political agenda.
Unbelievable. Yeah. It's all unbelievable. But again, before you leave us, Jim, could you please again point out to our listeners where to go to live stream the 911 conference in Vancouver and give us dates and times and stuff so that, you know, people can connect?
Absolutely. The website for the hearing is found at www.911vancouverhearings.com. Even simpler, if you just go to Common Ground, Bamboozled, you'll get the article about the four stories the mainstream media wouldn't print, plus a link to the hearings. And then I reiterate that for those who can't be in Vancouver for this historic event, it's going to be live streamed, and you can find the live stream information at liveonlocation.tv.
Excellent. Wow. That's, you know what, this is, it's almost too much to absorb. And I know you've just scratched the surface here, and I know that the conference is really going to do some digging. So, you know, from me personally, all the best with this conference. Go kick some butt, boy. There's some big fat butt to be kicking.
Thank you, Dee. Thank you, Christopher. Thank you, everyone involved. And, you know, let's we'll see you in Vancouver. Check us out.
Yes, thank you
so very much.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Jim. Before you leave, please give out how people can access your radio archives, because you have the most amazing collection at The Real Deal. If people put in The Real Deal,
Sure. Radiofetzer.blogspot.com. Radiofetzer.blogspot.com. Over 400 shows. These are two more in-depth interviews across a vast range of different subjects. A lot of fascinating guests. You're going to really enjoy it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
Okay. Well, I look forward to meeting you, Jim. Yeah.
Bye.
Okay. Hey, this is going to get good, because you're going to be there, aren't you?
Yeah. Wow. It's really very exciting. Hopefully we'll follow up and get Jim back afterwards, maybe that day, if we can get him and Alfred back.
Well, Alfred is confirmed. Oh. Alfred is definitely coming on the 23rd, and if we can add Jim in, that would be great, and Alfred is suggesting that maybe we can do that as well. So
yeah, excellent. That would be so good. Yeah, we hopefully will not have a problem doing that. It was excellent to have Jim on again.
Yeah, he's an awesome guest.
He's an encyclopedic knowledge of 9/11.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, I want to make the point again. We're going to go to break in a moment, but I want to make the point again. You know, as brilliant an analysis as Professor Fetzer and associates and colleagues of his have done over the last 10 years, and I include you in that because you've got an incredible section in your latest book on that, but the bottom line is, you know, it should be pretty much obvious to just about anybody right on the face of it that there's something wrong in the state of New York in this one.
Yeah, it's really discouraging, because it makes you realize how systemic the corruption is. Own police agencies and intelligence agencies and military, like all of these people kind of dishonor their oaths and perpetrate these things on the American public. It's terrible. It's outrageous. It's tragic.
And when Jim was talking about America turning from the world's most admired country to the world's most despised one, I was thinking to myself, and look what Harper did, following on the heels of Bush with his nose squarely up Bush's butt. He has turned Canada from a peacekeeping nation to a war-making nation. And Canadians need to think about that, too.
Yeah, and now we've been involved in two criminal wars, and Afghanistan was a criminal war. There should be people facing war crime charges.
Yes,
and then we were involved in Libya, another criminal war, always based on lies and public deception through the media.
Yes, you know, and now you've got a UN committee declaring that Canada is complicit in torture.
Yeah,
you know,
that happened last week. In Afghanistan. I mean, we were guilty of crimes to be there in the first place, because we had no right to. It was all based on lies and public deception. And these political leaders make me sick, the way they come out and they say, support your troops. What, support your troops to send them into wars based on lies for this?
I support the troops totally, as long as they're not committing murder and crimes at the behest of our government.
That's how I feel. Yeah, it's outrageous that they're using our troops like that. The troops, they go over there believing they're serving their country, and the whole time they're being deceived, and their whole countrymen are being deceived.
Perhaps that's part of the reason why the U.S. Department of the Military is now reporting that they have had 155 suicides in the first 6 months of this year, and and they've lost 154 men to war. So they're now losing, they're losing one a day. They're losing one a day over there to suicide in the U.S. Army. Why is that? They're losing them to suicide faster than the war.
I mean, you look back, Dee, when we were young, it was the Vietnam War, and 50,000 to 60,000 Americans died there. And then then you multiply many fold all those traumatized and disabled, and for what? And again, it was all based on lies. You see, these people don't, they have no respect for the military
nope.
in the United States.
Nope, whatsoever.
They have
and
no
of course,
respect
it's,
for
it. It's sort of like trying to trust a used car salesman. Okay, sure, I'm going to give you a good car. Well, why should I trust you? You know, it's that same thing. But we should go for our break.
Yeah, we should. And okay. Well, this song is my usual music that I use when I do take breaks, and it's by Robin. And that happens to be where I'm staying at the moment, with
Excellent.
Robin, sitting in the room, and outside the window is this beautiful view of BC Mountain.
Excellent.
And this is, the musical piece is called Sacred Land.
Awesome. So we'll be back in 5 minutes, so stay tuned.
I remember story my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain, the eagle soared high up in the sky. There wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life. Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. He brought his way of life. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought their gun. They took away our land. They put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation. Changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. The nations, they will rise. All the chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride. Armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride. Thank you.
CBSRadio.com, the number one internet talk radio network on the planet. This is Spider Turner, and you can buy my music at CDBaby.com. Pick me up, check me out. Ah, yeah, BBSRadio.com.
A problem.
State your problem.
Picking up transmission from Mars.
Well, we're back, and that was Sacred Land by Friend Robin. In the rest of the show, I'm going to share a little bit of just some impressions I've had from driving across Canada, and then I thought maybe we could discuss other things that are happening in the world situation or anything you'd like to pick up on.
Yeah, can we just take 2 minutes just before you do that, as a sort of a final wrap on this, I want to remind people again that the conference is going to be proceeding on this very, very quickly. It's this week, right? And, you know, do watch it. I mean, this is not an issue of it's so far over and done with that we don't need to look at it. This is the linchpin of all of it. And when you start realizing that when you come head on with such magnificent lies, and you can finally, after all this time, absorb the fact that the government is not there as your friend, the government is not there to protect you, the government is not serving you. If you can do that through the 911 proof that is being presented in Vancouver and has been presented all along, all over the world, then maybe you can get the idea that there's a whole lot more you need to dig into, all of which you're going to hear about, no doubt, Christopher, on Zero Point, right?
Yeah, we cover as wide a range as we can.
We possibly can. So now, you're in Nelson, BC. Range between ranges in the mountains, and it's absolutely stunningly beautiful out there. But you were telling us at the top of the show that you had a heck of a nice trip out viewing, you know, the countryside. It really is something when you see this country at ground level and go across it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Before I left, in the month or so before, I had been working at these two videos I've done on chemtrail spraying, one which I did on Parliament Hill in Ottawa, which people can access at my website, or it's on YouTube. And then I did a longer version, which is on the chemtrail poisoning of the citizens of Kempville, which is the area that I live in. And it's about a half hour long, and it has a soundtrack to it. And I'm going to divide it up and get it onto YouTube within the next couple of weeks. So I've become interested in this chemtrail issue. And it's the other issue which I always thought is right in your face. Like, when I look around me, what I see in the world, what is the evidence of the new world psychiatric disorder, I call it. And one of the things that stands in your face is the chemtrail spraying. Why can't people see this? And to me, in a way, the same people spraying us with the chemtrails are the same people behind 9/11.
It's exactly. You know, I was thinking something about what you just said, okay, this in-your-face thing, okay? Now, I live you've been in my neighborhood. You know what my neighborhood is like, okay? It's pretty much upper middle class and combined with some low middle class, and, you know, it's a pretty good mix. Nobody's super rich and nobody's super poor. people who generally have a fairly good handle on things. I point out a chemtrail in the sky, and they go, holy smokes, some of them. They say, isn't it interesting how those contrails are crossing each other? Well, you know, the thought came to me the other day. All these people who say, no, there's a contrails, and they'll evaporate, it's water vapor, blah, 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 which is also what we get out of our government. Has anybody ever thought to try and match up those flight paths with any flight that's recorded anywhere?
Yeah, and they obviously don't go to or come from the local commercial airport here. And
they don't come to or go to anywhere. This is the thing. They don't go anywhere. So what are they doing? They're above the normal flight paths. They don't make sense. They don't land at Pearson. So where do they land? Right?
Yeah, I think what smells like a duck and looks like a duck and leaves behind duck doings is a duck. And that's what I feel about the chemtrails. People have to face that it is an attempt to spread illness and have various biological, physiological effects through the chemtrails.
Well, now hang on to your hat, because two of those physiological effects have come across my desk in the last week. One of them being that, and we already know that samples have proven that there's a lot of aluminum being sprayed on us. And we've got aluminum-saturated soil and aluminum-saturated water and all kinds of other stuff. And so you're looking at aluminum. Well, what is aluminum? It's a metal. Okay, now you go back to smart meters. We've been talking on the show about smart meters. And we were talking even on the show a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about, it was about a month ago, I think it was, wasn't it? We had Eunice St. Clair from Citizens for Safe Technology on. And we were talking about how people who have a lot of water in their system, especially infants whose bodies have a lot of water, water is a conductor, metal is a conductor, and if our bodies are now infused with nanoparticles of aluminum, our bodies are now conductors, right?
Wow.
So they've made us conductive for EMF waves, and now the smart meter scenario is showing us that the thing that we're conductive to is killing us. Right?
Wow.
So you got that going on. And then now there's another thing coming from the air, and it's not chemtrails. They're saying that there is rabies vaccine that is contributing to what they're calling this zombie apocalypse, which everybody's gone crazy over in the last while. But when you hear all the stories coming out, starting with the guy in Miami, the homeless man who had his face eaten off, okay?
Yeah.
And I mean, all of that stuff's pretty weird, and Dr. Rebecca Carley is pointing out a connection between the Raberol vaccine, which is being distributed in food pouches to wild animals, especially like raccoons, in urban centers. And wait a minute here. All this stuff is converging just a little too quickly. You know what I mean? It's like all of a sudden, all these connections are being made with this thing over here being done and that thing over there being done. And what does the confluence of these things produce? So if we're looking at chemtrails coming down and the poisons we know are in the chemtrails, but then you add in the smart meters and you see that the smart meters interact with the first assault, doesn't that suggest that the whole thing was even a bigger plot than we thought?
Yeah, well, I mean, I see the main effect I've thought of the chemtrails is the increase in Alzheimer's and mental dementia in elders, because aluminum is known to cause Alzheimer's. That's why they took all the aluminum software, cooking software, they took it off the market.
Exactly.
And so then we've been sprayed with aluminum for 10 years now.
Yeah, and vaccinated with the stuff, too.
Yeah, in the vaccinations as well, yeah.
It's the same thing in the vaccinations with mercury, and believe me, they're not removing mercury from anything they don't have to by law, where they're ordered to, and they haven't been ordered to remove that much. But, again, you got mercury in vaccines, you got mercury poisoning in fish. They'll tell you not to eat more than a can of tuna a month because of the mercury in the tuna, but then they'll jam up your infant child who's just been born with all kinds of aluminum in the shots and mercury in the shots. You know?
I think in the infants have almost 40 enforced inoculations by the time they're 4 years old.
They've got about 26 in the province of Ontario before they're two.
Wow.
So, I mean, when you look at the kind of crap that they're, I mean, most of the stuff that's in vaccines belongs either in a hazmat bin or it belongs in the garage as part of a tool or something to repair your eavesdrop with. You know, that's where these materials belong. But they nanoparticleize these things. There's 10,000 applications for nanoparticle vaccines out there right now. 10,000 patents for nanoparticles. And, of course,
wow.
Nanoparticles, once you start ingesting them into your body in any form, these nanoparticles pass cell walls. They become part of who you are. They cannot be removed. They cannot be
wow.
removed. So, you know, you're dealing with some very, very deadly effects that are being transported to and delivered to, you know, the vast majority of the human population. And when you see it happening on that scale, and then all of a sudden you take a look at Agenda 21 and the Georgia
yeah.
Guidestones and all kinds of statements by all kinds of high-level people, and you look at Henry Kissinger calling the soldiers of America's wars nothing more than cannon fodder, you know, you start adding these things up, and if a look of horror doesn't come over your face, I got to ask you what kind of drugs you're on. You know what I mean? It's too
yeah.
obvious that
yeah,
we're under assault. It's far
most,
too obvious.
Most people are on TV, beer, and men playing games with balls.
Exactly.
It's
or
terrible.
Playing with... Well, never mind. I didn't say that. Anyways, so all this is going on. I'm noticing changes in society. You just got a cross cut in your travels. You got a cross cut of what Canadians are thinking. And knowing you, I don't think you stopped anywhere even for gas without talking to people about stuff that is important to Canadians.
That's true. I tried to tell people, talk to people across the country, and that's been interesting. And some people very interested. People knowing something's going on, but they don't really understand it. And different people I've engaged, and I've been giving out. I made hundreds of copies of my movie on chemtrail spraying. I did want to say about this movie. At the end of it, what I do is I quote the anti-terrorism laws in Canada, which explains it applies to any group which for political or ideological causes. It says that. And what we see with the New World Order elite is they have exactly these political ideological causes. And they
mm-hmm.
commit acts which endanger the health and well-being of Canadians. So the end of my chemtrail movie has these quotations of the Canadian anti-terrorist legislation, and I'm attempting to show how it applies perfectly to these people who are spraying us with chemtrails. That these people,
yes.
this be regarded as a form of terrorist activity, and these people need to be prosecuted under the anti-terrorism law.
Yeah, now, who do we prosecute first? know, how high do we go?
Well, I don't know. It's also overwhelming. I took my video to the local city council for my district and gave them all a copy. And I, of course, will never hear back from anyone. I must say, over the past month, at times, it leaves me despairing trying to do things, and it seems to have no impact. Or I put lectures on in Kempville and showed my movie and did some other lectures, and just a handful of people coming out, and then they're the people who are already informed. It's amazing the lack of concern. People don't grasp the seriousness of what's being done. And you know, when people are in danger, you need to learn about what's going on. Like, people think, oh, what can you do? And they just live in ignorance. Well, you can do a lot. And it's not just for you individually, it's also for your children and your grandchildren, and it's also for higher ideals, like the ideals of justice and truth and love in the world, these things. You know,
yeah, I think people really need to stop living behind their own picket fences. They need to venture with their minds outside their own life and take a look. I know it's hard. People are pressured. People are stressed. People are out of money. A lot of people are out of work. A lot of people are struggling to keep their homes.
Yeah.
And this is going, you know, across North America. But if you don't look,
you don't have
an opportunity to do anything about it. If you look, you find out lots of things you can do.
Yeah.
But
I mean,
and lots of people you can talk to. And you can start at your own local level. Tell your neighbors, tell your friends, tell your relatives, talk to your city councilor. There's stuff to tell them that's enough to curl their hair. But just to give you an example of how cut off people are, even in a great big cosmopolitan city like Toronto, they call it the big smoke. I call it the big smoke and mirrors. But at any rate, recently our city council decided, you know, this 5 cent per bag charge that you've got in the retail stores. Our city council, in their so-called wisdom, has decided that by the end of 2013, thou shalt have no plastic bags in the city of Toronto. They're banning plastic bags entirely.
Wow.
I'm going, you know, if they asked anybody, they'd get, what are you, nuts? But they don't talk to anybody. And then the mayor turns around and he says, well, it's the people's fault. They don't involve themselves. Well, you know what? On one hand, I want to kick him for saying that, because none of them should have been dumb enough to agree to that, but they all were. But on top of that, he's right. We don't involve ourselves. We don't open our eyes. We are having enough of a struggle at home. Oh, let George do it. Well, we've been letting George do it for a long time. And by George, I think that George that they referred to had the last name of Bush. And he did us without even kissing us first. So, you know, all of this is a result of our own complicity, if not complacency, because we have sat there and said nothing and done nothing. We outnumber the buggers. You know, we outnumber them so overwhelmingly that we have the power. We, the people, have the power. But we, the people, have to stand up and stop looking like a bunch of sheep.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
Exactly. It all comes back to just the growing awakening. It needs to be amped up tenfold. And we all need to begin locally and consider what we can do. And also people need to make preparations, like consider what they would do if various scenarios came down, how they'd provide for themselves or how they would manage. These are important issues. I think we're at risk because these people are being exposed so widely and people are putting it together more. And you see the groundswell of more people becoming involved in the political process who want to bring about change at different levels. That's occurring. So I think some hope. I meant to ask you, Dee, what do you see of what's going on in Quebec City? I'm sure we're not being reported to very fairly through the main media about what's been going on in Quebec, but I understand their demonstrations have escalated. Do you know what's currently going on in Montreal or Quebec?
Well, I know that they've bumped up the security for the for some games that they're having there, and I know that you know, they're sort of treating it like it's being played down in the media to some extent, but on the other hand, I think it's way more of a powder keg than they choose to admit. And I think that the powder keg issue there is really the fact that the government isn't listening to anybody. I think that's the big issue, is that the government is paying no attention to what the people want at all.
Yeah.
So when you get people who are that angry because that many have been affected, and then you've got all these people standing up in solidarity with the original bunch, you got a situation.
Yeah.
They got a situation there. It's not going away this week. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I think these people are going to be doing what they do for a while yet.
Yeah.
But sorry for the static on my line.
There is a lot of static on your line.
Yeah, I know it's really bad. We're
just
basically
don't move the phone too much, or the wires, or the cords.
Well, I'm on a cordless. I'm trying to find a position. I found one, like right now, I'm in a position where there's no static.
Here's the key. Cordless are terrible when you're dealing with radio.
Yeah, I know, but it's what I've got.
Okay, so just off air, we were just discussing some static problems we're having. I don't think... It's interesting, Dee. I mean, you don't see other pockets of protest and people coming together, I don't think, in Canada that I know of. I really don't have a sense of that. It would be so interesting to have a Canadian news network.
You mean a real one?
Sorry?
You mean a real one?
Well, a full-time one.
Yeah, an honest one.
Well, yeah, and I was thinking internet, because it's internet radio where the scene is, I think. Like, it's just so important. It's filling this great gap that we've had in our media. I mean, it's a world unto itself being on the internet radio.
Well, people are so sick of mainstream media now. I mean, if you read the forums even on some of the news sites, it's really getting funny because... of course, people who care are the ones who go and comment, and they're also the ones who are paying attention. So you're getting a whole lot of stuff coming out on these forums. And yesterday, I know it's almost getting ridiculous. People are looking for a conspiracy under every rock now, and the racehorse, the Canadian bred racehorse who won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. And got injured before the Belmont, and now is retiring from racing. There was even a guy on the CBC forum yesterday saying, "Oh, it's a conspiracy. They took out the Canadian horse, blah blah blah." And I'm going, "Hang on here, pal. I've had horses all my life, and I know what a splint injury is. And no, there was no predicting it. But you see, this is a mentality that people have." This is what they have. Once you break that barrier, you start looking, and some people have felt this. I know I did when I started out. People looked at me and said I was crazy because I was talking about the things that I talk about now. And ever since then, it's been a large case of I told you so, because everything I've said has come true, and they now know it. So that's gratifying on the one hand, but there's a lot of people just waking up now. And they're going to be running into that same stuff everywhere they go. Oh, come on, that couldn't be true. Oh, you're full of it. No. You know, and this is how it goes. So a lot of people shut down because they don't like being called a fool. They don't like being called a conspiracy theorist. So they shut up.
Yeah.
You know,
I think there's more already now. That's been my current experience, like in talking to people I've met along the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was interesting. Just as an example, I stopped one place in the morning at like 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was an Oriental woman there, and I asked her if she knew about chemtrails, and she didn't, and I explained a little bit, and I said, they're outside now, and she was really interested. She actually came outside, had a look at them in the sky, and then took my video and was really interested. Like, there's just something. Different people, a young girl at the first bureau who was so interested when I mentioned what I was doing, going to the 9/11 conference, and it just opened up, and she was fascinated. Like, she stayed half hour beyond when her place was supposed to be closed down because she had all these questions and wanted to know what to do and what could people do. And
yeah,
it's hard to know what to do. No one does know what to do. We do what we can, but we're not, you know, it's overwhelming in a way.
Well, listen, Christopher, are you hearing all the static coming from my line?
Less so now than I was hearing more before.
Yeah, well, that's because I'm trying to move around in my house to find a spot where there isn't any static, and I find one, and then the static finds me.
And
it's really affecting the quality of the broadcast, and I'm thinking maybe it would be a better idea if you closed the show and told everybody what you need to tell them about your trip, and we spare them the oral agony of listening to this static. What do you think?
Well, I'm not finding the static bad at the moment, Dee.
It's fine, but it will be.
I can hear it. But, yeah, that's fine, Dee. And we were going to close up a little bit on time today, a few minutes early. Take the next 20 minutes.
We get to talking, and there's just so much to say.
There's so much going on, and, yeah.
Well, I mean, if our voices would hold up and our bodies would hold up, we could probably do this 24/7 without missing a beat.
It's been nice to get away from it for me. It's been so nice to get off the internet since I've been traveling the last week and just get a break from it all.
Yeah, but you're on a busman holiday, Christopher.
Yeah, it has been a holiday in a way.
But,
I was going to say, Dee, so I was traveling across the country. I thought I'd try to do a chemtrail poisoning of the citizens of Canada video next.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to get footage across Canada. But I drove all the way through northern Ontario, and I kind of saw no chemtrails at all. It was beautiful skies. Winnipeg and then Swift River.
That might actually have to do with the weather systems that have been pushed through in the last little while, too. You know, they're careful about when they lay them as well as where.
Yeah, that's true, I think. But my conclusion a bit is that I think they actually do target regions and populations. I don't think it's indiscriminate spraying over areas where there's not a larger population.
No,
I think
they're not interested in populated areas.
Say, Dee?
Yeah. Christopher?
Anyway, okay, I'll let you go, Dee.
I'm sorry. My wall's waterlogged from all the rain, and that's why the wire is all screwed up. But we'll talk later. God bless, take care, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. And please continue to listen to Dr. Holmes.
Okay. Bye,
okay,
Dee. Thank you.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Okay. Well, yeah, Dee did have a lot of static. And I've had an odd connection today. So it's been difficult for me to hear a bit on my cell phone and my headset. But anyway, we've got about 20 minutes left, so... So I've been driving across Canada, and it's been really nice to get out. I kind of fitted up the back of my van and got a mattress there and a cooler and everything I need, and so I can just sleep out in my van at night, and I park here and there and in different areas, and have found nice sites along the way and did some camping. I haven't set my tent out yet, which I hope to do after the conference this week. It begins Friday, so I have like 5 days to get to Vancouver. And then afterwards, I hope to tour Vancouver Island and some of the smaller islands off the BC coast. Canada is an absolutely beautiful country. It's really quite spectacular driving across and seeing all the variants of the terrain and the landscape and such. It's really quite beautiful. Northern Shores Lake Superior is really quite spectacular and beautifully clean water. And Canada's so gifted to have such abundant water supplies, and we have to kind of fear what's being intended for the use of those.
So it's been interesting driving across Canada, and for me, it kind of got me out of my house, and I hadn't been out for over a year since my sweetheart had died a year ago, and we had traveled this route together, and so it's a way of me trying to resolve memories and let go of my past and you know, try to be brave in facing the future. And in a way, for me, it's a part of a vision quest to travel across Canada and not be made afraid to do something, to take part in this Vancouver conference, which for me is a major thing. I'm not otherwise a political person. My interest is in mystical teachings and modern science and higher states of consciousness and subjects along that line. And my latest book, 1137, is the only book of my six books which is on on the world situation and which has a political, social, political nature. 1137. It goes into aspects of 9/11 and the New World Order and Agenda 21 and everything from inoculations to chemtrails. And so it's my kind of political view, political work. And I think it's a very valuable book for people because I think it helps break the mass hypnosis or the way their minds have been conditioned. And it's written in part as a way of breaking people's conditioning to wake them up. And I think that flavor comes across in my book 1137. And parts of it are autobiographical a bit, talking about some of the things that I and my partner, Karen, things we had done since we had woken up. So it's written on a more personal level than my other books. And it's nice to actually have some time to try to promote my other work. I would like to encourage people to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca and look at the other books I have available. I've written some really very profound books, and I consider the most important of these to be The Heart Doctrine, Mystical Views of the Origin and Nature of Human Consciousness. And this book explains how the whole of Western science and psychology for the past century has dismissed the idea of human beings having a spirit or soul and regards human consciousness as produced by the material brain centered in the head. And what I do is I contrast this with the mystical spiritual teachings which connect the self and the origins of consciousness with the human heart. And so I present the Heart Doctrine, drawing from all different mystical teachings, showing that the Heart Doctrine teaching is common to different religions. So rather than religions all being dissimilar, in a way they all share this teaching of the heart, the esoteric teaching of the heart, that God is known through the heart, that I is known within the heart. One yogi defines self-realization as involving the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. Because most people's consciousness is centered up in the mind, in the egoic nature, in the personality. And what we have to do is break down some of that mind conditioning and free our mind. And then consciousness can resolve and we can experience ourselves more directly connected to the heart and within the heart. And we can experience ourselves through our blood flow in our body, because I believe consciousness in the body is connected to the blood flow, the oxygenation of the body. Consciousness isn't produced by the brain's neurophysiological processes. So the Heart Doctrine book of mine looked at this issue of the nature of human consciousness. And it also looked at the zero point concept, the idea that there is a
something like a divine spark or spiritual spark, like a point source element connect within each human being. So I look at the zero point origins of consciousness. So it's a very unique book on the consciousness issue, and quite unlike anything I'm familiar with in the existing literature. Secondly, I have a very profound book on Blavatsky's secret doctrine, explaining the physics and metaphysics of the secret doctrine in light of modern science. So this is one, the secret doctrine was published in 1888 and is one of the most profound books of the modern world. And it's a classical book of Western occultism. And my explanations of the secret doctrine are really very profound, explaining how Blavatsky anticipated many modern concepts, including the idea of vacuum genesis in science, the idea of singularities, creation from singularities, expanding, contracting space-time, seven-dimensional hyperspace, non-local effects, and many more other advanced concepts in physics were anticipated by the secret doctrine of Blavatsky. I then have two books explaining the fourth-way teaching of mystic G.I. Gurdjieff. One of the books, Psychological Illusions, explains the Gurdjieff psychological teaching in a systematic and complex way while comparing it with other Western thinking. And the second book, called The Slugs, is on Gurdjieff's masterpiece, Veils Above Sails, to his grandson. This is one of the most bizarre books of the sacred books of the modern world. It's a classic like Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. And my newest version of The Slugs has very interesting analysis of Gurdjieff's views of the causes of war and human psychopathology and the causes of war. And I've incorporated an analysis of our modern situation. I've incorporated that into my analysis of Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's tales. So it brings out a whole other level of hidden meaning in Beelzebub's tales, which I think has generally been overlooked, which is Gurdjieff's views on the crisis in the life of humanity and the role of what he calls the various crats, like the aristocrats and the democrats and the plutocrats, different scoundrels of different dyes who are what Gurdjieff calls hasnamuses, people who lack individual conscience. And Gurdjieff explains he sees conscience as representative of divinity in a person. So for Gurdjieff, the awakening of consciousness, of conscience, is very important in a person's psycho-spiritual transformation. It goes along with the awakening of the heart. And then lastly, I have a book on zero-point teaching, which really looks at this concept of the zero-point origins of self and compares it to the zero-point origins of the universe. And that book is, I produced it also last year. My last two books were dedicated to Karen, who had been with me through the 10 years of work that went into these last two books. So anyway, I would encourage people, have a look at my website. I try to put a lot of my writing up on zeropoint.ca because it's more important to share my work really than simply to sell the books. But it's also, they're all quite complex and scholarly type books and really a valuable addition to anyone's library. So anyway, part of my travels, I like to stop at used bookstores, and I found some treasures of books. The first one I found that I've been reading the last days, hard to get my mind out of it, is The Esoteric World of Madame Blavatsky: Insights into the Life of a Modern Sphinx. and it's absolutely a remarkable book, explaining recounting all varied accounts of paranormal and occult phenomena produced by Blavatsky or around Blavatsky. And it's really a most peculiar book, an astonishing report. And of course, it's always hard to judge the truth of the veracity of the report. But many of them, they're written very intelligently and often by people who were initially skeptical or very critical, and there were multiple incidents of things. Blavatsky became known in America during the 1870s when spiritualism became the craze. And she came over, but she, in a way, dismissed some forms of mediumship and had different arguments about what mediumship involved and discouraged it in ways. But Blavatsky manifested all kinds of supernatural phenomena around her, including the type of spirit tappings, which are a popular part of spiritualism. Many other supposed events, teleportation of objects and varied manifestations. This is an absolutely fascinating book, The Esoteric World of Madame Blavatsky, with all these personal accounts of people who knew her and had met her. For anyone, Blavatsky's one of my heroes. She used to call herself the old hippopotamus because she was quite stoutly and a very peculiar woman, an incessant smoker, apparently, always rolling her little tobacco cigarettes, and also had a strong proclivity for hashish. So this fascinating book on Madame Blavatsky, that was one of the treasures I found. Then I found another excellent book on Ramana Maharshi. A few years ago, I had my house burned down, so I had lost my esoteric library of books I'd collected for 40 years. So for me to find some of these kind of classic books on some of these mystic saints is really very valuable. And while I've been traveling, I've also been reading this excellent book, The Secret Doctrine of the Kabbalah, by Leonarda Leet, a Jewish woman. I think she's in New York. It's a profound book. It's very scholarly, and it's the kind of a book that one would have to study and reread to gain more, to understand it more deeply. But she had some amazing things in this book. The thing that caught my attention most, she's talking about what are called the three mother letters, sound or vowels. And they are, she associates the sound of E, like E, spelled E-E, with the head. And the sound of the heart, she says, is ah, A-H. And the sound of the lower third of the body is the sound O, O-O. So the sound of the heart, according to her analysis, and she ties this into looking at the Tetragrammaton and the four-letter name of God and so on. The sound of the heart, she says, is ah. And I encourage people, try to encourage your heart consciousness sometimes to try to resonate that sound within yourself of ah, A-H. And if you resonate that deeply, you can feel it. It all vibrates in your breastbone, in your body, that sound of awe. And it's like you see something that engages your sympathies, and you would go, ah, like, ah, this happened to you, ah. Like, it's like your heart is open. You have sympathy for someone, like, ah. And so that's the concept, that sound from this book on The Secret Doctrine of Kabbalah. That is one of the principal sounds she associates with the human heart and the opening of the heart. And that was all very profound to me. partly because I say ah a lot like that and do it intuitively, and also because that was so characteristic of Karen. And I always saw that whenever she would see something, pain or hurt or things along that line, she would say, ah, ah. It would be like her heart was open and she would take that situation in upon herself. So anyway, I'm on a bit of an adventure here. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time, hopefully with Jim Fetzer and Alfred Weber, in 2 weeks' time after the conference is over. And I'll continue to try to document chemtrails across Canada, see what I can see. And hopefully we'll be back in 2 weeks' time and we'll have an excellent conference this year. This is an important 9/11 Truth Conference. I think really people are stepping up to the plate and taking the research and conclusions further than has been done. And it's hard to know what to do in this crazy, crazy, lunatic world, but we have to all try to do something. When I pass over and I'm asked by the Lord, what did you do? I don't want to say I sat home drinking beer and watching men play games with balls. I want to stand up for my country and my nation, for my neighbors, for what I believe in as higher spiritual values. The belief in truth and beauty and love as property. So this has been an important trip for me. It helped me shift the focus in my life and to try to face this unknown and come to a new vision. So thank you, BBS Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye, all. By the grace of God, we'll carry on this adventure. Goodbye.